I next met with Dr. Ann LaCase. To begin, I asked her to summarize where we are today with important clinical trials that are maturing that focus on the management of advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma.
So, you know, I think we're all waiting for the advanced stage brentuximab plus ABD versus ABVD study, and I think that is very likely to be practice changing for advanced stage disease. And I think in the early stage, I think we're sort of in stage one and two, we're trying to look at peeling back on therapy and particularly in radiation. So I think we're using a lot less radiotherapy and we're doing, you know, based on the intergroup study led by David Strauss at the Alliance, you know, his data for four of ABVD for stage one and two non-bulky who are PET negative after two looks very good. So I think we're going to be doing less in that setting and likely adding brentuximab up front for advanced stage. Hopefully in the future we'll have some data for bulky because I think that's the one group where, you know, we really don't have data yet on omitting radiation. But I think the thing that I see most often in the community is that people will delay cycle one, day 15, because the patient is inevitably neutropenic. And the risk of febrile neutropenia is less than 1% per cycle. So you don't want to stop and you don't want to give growth factors because it enhances the risk of bleal lung. And people don't need it. If you have someone who gets into trouble, you drop the bleo, you know, give Neupogen, but they only need a few days. Otherwise, you give these young people Neulasta, they have horrible bony pain and they just don't need it because they don't get FNN. If they happen to get FNN, then you can add 3 or 4 days of Neupogen from like days 5 to 9. And all the U.S. intergroup studies mandated no dose reduction, treat regardless of white count. For this reason, no prophylactic growth factors. You see it over and over again that people will dose reduce or delay. And this is such a highly curable disease that that's the one message I would try to get out there.
What about in terms of relapse disease? I see a lot of interest in the ATHERA study, specifically in terms of the indication to use it clinically. Can you talk a little bit about your take on those data?
So that's for people who relapsed early, primary refractory, or had extranodal disease. So, you know, I think that data shows that it delays relapse, but there doesn't appear to be a difference in overall survival. And I think you have to be ready to drop the drug because you see people get motor neuropathy with brentuximab, which you just don't see with vinblastine. So I think it's very reasonable to consider, but I think you have to watch people carefully on that and stop if they get into trouble.
One other thing about Hodgkin I wanted to ask you about. You know, obviously one of the really important developments in Hodgkin lymphoma has been the evolution of checkpoint inhibitors. So I'm going to get your take a little bit about your experience with checkpoint inhibitors, but also if you could backtrack through some of the biology in terms of why it is that Hodgkin seems to be so sensitive and what your current vision is in general for the biology of Hodgkin lymphoma.
So it's really interesting work by Margaret Shipp and others have shown that the Reed-Sternberg cell has amplification or copy number gain in chromosome 9p, which encodes PD-L1 and PD-L2. And this is found pretty much across the board. Most of the cases that have been examined are NS Hodgkin's, but also appears to be true in mixed cellularity. And this makes Hodgkin's really the poster child for using checkpoint inhibition. And that's really been borne out, I think, in the studies where in all the studies in the relapse refractory setting, patients have 60 to 70% overall response rates. And, you know, I think now the question is, how do we best incorporate these into the relapse and upfront management? I mean, currently, I think we're using them mostly post-auto, but we just did a study, Philippe Armand just completed a study doing post-auto consolidation with 6 months of pembrolizumab. So we look forward to seeing what that looks like. But I think it's a really attractive idea as the immune system is regenerating after auto. And then the question becomes, what about upfront? Should we be consolidating high-risk patients? I think the problem is that we have such successful regimens that how to design studies to answer a question is becoming very complicated. And we're just talking with Philippe Armand about this because in the upfront setting, the cure rates are so good with ABVD alone. So in whom do you think about adding the additional toxicity of checkpoint inhibitors or brentuximab vedotin, and how do you do those studies? And it's still a big question.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, when you were talking about using Bevacizumab up front, I've always been curious about that trial and that whole question about events.
Right.
And how big the trial has to be and how big the effect's going to have to be. I kind of wonder if it has sort of a modest effect, whether they're going to miss it.
Right. I mean, I think we'll see an effect. I think the data supposedly is going to be released at some point this year, and I think it will be a positive trial. But I think in the upfront setting for early stage, I think there's more of a question there. Is there going to be a role there given the very good outcomes with chemo alone? You know, you'd have to do an exceedingly large study to see a difference between 92 and 96%. And is that really clinically meaningful, and at what cost and what potential toxicity? So it's getting really interesting because of successful regimens. You know, it's a good position to be in.
You know, I actually talked to Dr. Armand, and one of the things that we kind of got into, and I was really thinking about it after the interview, was the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in people who've had allo.
Yeah.
And like, what happens there immunologically? Any thoughts about that?
So he just published with one of our current hemonc fellows a paper in Blood looking at this question, and they do appear to see more GVH, but it seems to be fairly manageable, and it looks like the outcomes in those patients look very good as well. So I think it's really going to be a matter of timing and watching, you know, very cautiously for toxicity. But it's, you know, we're doing very few allos in Hodgkin's now. I can't remember the last patient I sent for an allo, but when we put them on checkpoint inhibitors and they're continuing along on checkpoint inhibitors, we're saying, well, we'll just keep going until they clearly have progression. But we have a lot of patients who've had sort of partial remissions that have been durable, at least for a year, 2 years. It's interesting.
I'm just kind of curious. I always ask people whenever we get up and talk about checkpoint inhibitors, you know, obviously there are a lot of people with all kinds of tumors getting them. Have you encountered any patients who had pre-existing autoimmune disease?
We've been pretty careful on the trials, very clearly exclude those patients. And I think, you know, we really need to have a better understanding of what T-cell subsets are being affected. And I think there's a lot of research going on at the Farber and other places to try to really understand this so we can, you know, not blanketly say, okay, if you have RA, you're never going to get one of these drugs, because I think we're going to be facing that more and more.
So let's talk about some of your cases beginning, and we can just, you know, kind of summarize what you think the key teaching point was related to the case. We don't have to go through everything, but I think the amount of information you have here is about right. So let's start out with your 49-year-old man with CLL.
Right. So he initially presented with small volume adenopathy without a big white count. Really nice, you know, relatively anxious guy, sort of your typical early stage CLL patient. And he had unmutated heavy chain genes, which becomes important in this situation. And we followed him for a number of years, and his white count was never terribly high. It was in the 30, 40,000 range. But he had incredible tonsillar involvement and neck nodes to the point where he developed frank sleep apnea, and his airway was incredibly narrowed. So we actually treated him on that basis. Given that he was well under 65, we treated him with FCR, given this was a number of years ago. It was, what, 2005? It was when he first presented, and we started treating him in 2013.
Could I just ask you, you know, it's, when you talk about, you know, airway narrowing, it's starting to sound a little scary.
Yeah.
When you saw him from the beginning.
Right.
When you saw that happening, did you kind of, like, think, I wish I'd treated him earlier?
Well, he wasn't terribly symptomatic other than, you know, the snoring, and I was starting to get nervous, so I treated him earlier. If he hadn't had that, I would have definitely waited significantly longer, but it was sort of preemptively.
And this is from adenopathy?
Adenopathy, and I think tonsillar and adenoid enlargement. His tonsils were, you know, opposed at the back of his
wow.
airway. It was pretty impressive.
So he got FCR?
So he got FCR, which he tolerated extremely well, and it just, his disease melted away, but it was back within 2 years. So it was really, you know, sort of in keeping with someone who was unmutated, and he knew that this was not going to be curative therapy.
Could I just backtrack a little bit there in terms of your decision? And it is a basic question, but it's always, I like getting people's view on it, in terms of FCR versus ibrutinib in a patient like this today. Still go with FCR?
I would still go with FCR, though I know that even within my own group where we have two CLL experts who do a lot of the clinical trials, they disagree. One of them would give FCR and say, well, we don't know the long-term outcomes in ibrutinib. There are some patients, even in unmutated setting, who are going to do well for 4 or 5 years. I would do that first and then go to ibrutinib second line. Whereas the other colleague would say, you know, FCR is toxic. It can cause, you know, stem cell damage, MDS. Why expose someone to that if you know that they're not going to have a long-term remission? And, you know, I think I could go either way. But in someone as young as this, I think I would still, at this point, give FCR, though we have a trial that is combining the two, ibrutinib plus FCR, which I think is a really interesting study, and it gives option for patients to come off after 2 years of ibrutinib if they are MRD negative. So I think that is a really interesting approach.
From a clinical perspective, when you see a patient who's getting an FCR up front, mutated, non-mutated, what kind of outcome are you looking at over the next 5 years?
So for the unmutated patients, I would think clearly more than half are going to be relapsing before 5 years, whereas the patients who are mutated, the data from MD Anderson suggests that there may be a subset of patients who are cured. You know, I think we need to follow patients for a very long time to know that, but there are patients 10, 15 years out who still haven't recurred. So the unmutated clearly associated with inferior PFS.
So this patient relapsed, and at that point, I would assume that off protocol, you would have been thinking ibrutinib?
Right. Exactly.
And I see that actually he went on a protocol.
He went on a protocol.
What was the protocol?
So he's getting ibrutinib and obinutuzumab.
That's an interesting combination.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, has ibrutinib been looked at with rituximab?
I'm sure it must have been, but no major publications. Yeah.
So how long has he been on treatment at this point?
So he has finished the obinutuzumab part. So he's been on about 6 months. And he's done exceedingly well. And he had quite bulky adenopathy before he started. And he's tolerated it. He's had really no problems. He had a little bit of neutropenia with the obina, but he's done really well.
No infusion reaction with the obina?
He had minor infusion reaction, but not much.
How is that shaken out? You know, more typically, maybe you would see an older patient getting ibrutinib. I don't know if you're using chlorambucil with it. I don't know if you're using it. But how are you using it? And what have you been seeing in terms of infusion reaction?
So I've seen some pretty major. I had one older patient that I was going to give obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil to. And he had multiple cardiac risk factors, kind of a nervous guy, and he had a very, you know, became immediately hypotensive, and he said, no, not again, you know. So I think it seems to be a little bit different than the rituximab infusion reactions, but, you know, I think we're lucky in that we have nurses who are very adept at recognizing and stopping early, and we pre-medicate people a lot. And, you know, I think you break up the dose.
I'm going to ask you in a little bit about the big paper at ASH looking at obinutuzumab and follicular lymphoma.
Yeah.
But there they found that even though there was more infusion reaction, the number of people coming off therapy was the same. Is that your clinical experience with CLL that usually you generally get people through
usually
it?
Usually get people through it, yeah.
And so this man is now, what, on ibrutinib alone?
He's on ibrutinib alone.
And what's his clinical status in terms of tumor?
So his marrow's clean, which is pretty remarkable, and his nodes have shrunk dramatically. Not quite completely gone, but...
And I guess you'll be continuing him indefinitely with the ibrutinib.
Right, yeah.
Any thoughts about this combination and where you think it might be heading?
I think it's a great combination. I think, you know, knowing that ibrutinib has very high overall response rates but low complete remission rates, I think the idea of adding a monoclonal antibody, in particular the data supporting obinutuzumab and CLL being a better antibody than rituximab, I think is pretty clear. So I think it's a very enticing combination. I think acalabrutinib is a very interesting drug. And, you know, I think over time, based on the toxicity profile, you know, it does not have the bleeding and the atrial fibrillation, at least early. It hasn't been seen to the same degree. So that would be even more appealing, I think.
And it seems like, you know, I guess in this initial work that the acalabrutinib efficacy seems similar to ibrutinib.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, it's a very potent, very selective, or more selective than ibrutinib.
Any other BTK inhibitors out there that look promising?
I don't know any. I know of some that are in clinical trials, but I think the approval strategies are going to be very difficult. And I think even for acalabrutinib, which I would love to see approved because it's just, it's a good drug for elderly patients. I think ibrutinib, if we talk about, I have another patient and several others who've had to come off for toxicity. So I think acalabrutinib is a safer, better tolerated drug.
When you talk about toxicities with ibrutinib from a clinical point of view, and you mentioned older patients, what are some of the more frequent issues that you run into?
Bleeding. You know, I've had a couple of people have falls and have giant hematoma. I've had a patient who had a subdural hematoma. We've seen another patient in the clinic who had a bad bilateral subdurals with really minimal trauma. And the atrial fibrillation, I think, is a big issue. And then these patients, often being older, meet criteria for needing anticoagulation. So then you've got the double whammy. You've got someone who needs to be on one of the novel agents, the anticoagulants, plus ibrutinib, and then their risk of bleeding is even higher. So I don't think any of us know exactly what the best way to manage need for anticoagulation in patients on ibrutinib.
So let's move on and talk about your 87-year-old man. Speaking of CLL, interesting case. Let's hear about him.
So he's this delightful 87-year-old guy who actually, he was laid off from his job when he was 82 or 83 and was really upset about it. So he's this like very vibrant guy. And I initially met him in 2002 and he had trisomy 12. And we watched him for about 5 years, and he had progressive lymphocytosis and developed anemia, needed therapy. So at that time in 2007, we didn't really have a lot of data on BR, so I gave him fludarabine plus rituximab, which he tolerated just fine and had no real toxicity. He relapsed about 4 years later and gave him BR at that time. He did great. Though he developed more recently, he's had some trouble with recurrent aspiration and lots of pneumonias and was hypogammaglobulinemic, so we put him on replacement. And then he just had progressive anemia and fatigue and splenomegaly. So I put him on ibrutinib, and this man has a non-invasive bladder cancer, and he's had multiple, you know, he has to have cystoscopies every couple of months, and he's had multiple resections. And he just, as soon as he started the drug, he's very steady on his feet, but he had a fall at home and he fell on his, you know, in his sacral area, got admitted to a local hospital. And I had told him, I had told his wife, who's very sharp, you know, any bleeding, this needs to be held. And they were giving him the drug at the outside hospital. They never called me to tell me he was in the hospital initially. And then finally we got through and said, hold the drug. And then he got better, but he had a big hematoma, retroperitoneal bleeding. And then he eventually went back on, but he just had recurrent episodes of hematuria. So we finally gave up on ibrutinib for him and then put him on venetoclax. And his white count was sort of in the intermediate risk. He was over 25,000. So we brought him in the hospital to give him the dose escalation, which he did really well with. And he remains on venetoclax full dose. He's been on it now probably 6 months, doing very well.
And, you know, it's interesting, when I saw venetoclax, I immediately assumed it was 17P, but it's not.
No, you can get it.
What do we know about venetoclax in non-17P CLL?
It's great. Has a high response rate. You know, I know the indication now is only in 17P, but I think there are a lot of patients like this who are older who are not great candidates for ibrutinib. I think many people's enthusiasm for idelalisib in combination with rituximab has kind of dropped based on the toxicity reports, CMV reactivation, PCP, VZV, colitis. You know, it's not an easy drug. And venetoclax is so well tolerated in those elderly patients that I hope that we can see more in, you know, some of the combination studies with obinutuzumab plus venetoclax. And people are thinking about, you know, I think there are upcoming combinations of BTK inhibitors plus venetoclax as well, and they should be synergistic or at least additive and well tolerated. So I think this field continues to just explode.
You know, one of the issues I was going to ask you about before when we were talking about FCR versus ibrutinib was the concept of indefinite therapy that seems to bother people a lot, although sometimes I hear people say, well, hey, it's just another pill, you know, at least once you kind of get started. And I always think to myself, well, maybe that's not the way it's always going to be. You know, maybe by combining different strategies, you'll be able to have short-term therapy. Is that your thinking?
Yeah, and I think that's where some of these new trials are, you know, built-in discontinuation if people are MRD negative and then watching them to see what happens. And I think that's a very appealing strategy because, you know, I think the financial toxicity of being on these drugs. You know, initially when they came out, it was very easy to get people drug. It is not as easy as it was. And particularly for people who have some means but not a lot, it is increasingly difficult.
You mentioned that you put this man in the hospital to get the initial treatment with venetoclax. How long was he in there? What do you typically do when you admit people to the hospital, and when do you discharge him?
There's very nice criteria in the prescribing information, and I always pull it up because I want to make sure that I am remembering it carefully. And I think if there's any question, if you have an older patient, any renal insufficiency, or someone that you're worried may not be able to come back for the 6 or 8 hour or the next day, I would bring that patient in the hospital for 2 days and just observe the post-initiation, you know, make sure there's no tumor lysis, watch them carefully, bring them back in for the next step up. So I would definitely err on the side of caution of bringing people in, particularly older patients.
How long do they usually stay in?
A couple of days, 2 days.
Right.
Yeah.
What about testing for 17p over time? Do these tumors change?
Yes, they do. So the mutational status doesn't change, but you can definitely acquire a 17p. So I think anytime you're going to reinitiate new therapy or someone has a change in clinical behavior, and sometimes when you think they have a Richter's transformation, they don't actually. They have acquired 17p and they have more aggressive appearing disease, which can look, if you biopsy a node, it can look more aggressive. And the FDG avidity, if you're doing a PET scan to look for an area to biopsy, it can be more FDG avid.
Anything else you want to say about CLL? Anything that we haven't talked about that you want to comment on?
You know, I think that the other question that comes up is, when do you think about sending someone for allogeneic transplant when you have younger patients? And I think this remains an issue, but I think if you're looking at a patient and they're on venetoclax and they're young or they have 17p and you're worried that there's not going to be a next agent available for them to get them back in remission, I think it's that point that you want to refer them for a discussion of transplant, because you really want to go in with as little disease as possible. And if you have exhausted everything, you may get into trouble.
What about the issue of PI3 kinase inhibition in CLL, specifically adalimumab? And I know there are other agents being looked at.
I don't know what's going to happen with those drugs. There's the TGR drug as well, which appears to be maybe less toxic, but I don't know how much data there is specifically in CLL. That drug is being looked at in follicular, TGR-1202.
What has been seen, first of all, in terms of efficacy, particularly with adalimumab? Do you ever use it in CLL? And globally, what's your take on the tolerability issues?
So I think in older patients, it actually may be a better drug than in younger patients, because there's data from Jennifer Brown, and one of our fellows wrote up. She had an upfront study where they started idelalisib and then ofatumumab was added. And very early during therapy, people developed significant hepatitis, transaminitis, and it was immune mediated. So the thought is that patients who are mutated may be more likely to get this, and people who are younger and have a more intact immune system. So I have used it in older patients who are anticoagulated. And I think in the short term, it's actually quite well tolerated in that group of patients, but you got to watch for CMV, you got to prophylax them. And then if they get the colitis, which is typically delayed, or pneumonitis, then you're going to have to take them off study. So I'm worried about that class of drugs because of the toxicity. And I don't know whether, you know, some of the more specific ones or more potent ones, I think we'll have to see what happens with that field, because clearly it's a target that works. But
what about CAR T-cell therapy? Is that at a point where you ever think about that, you know, in the patients that you're managing in terms of, you know, a realistic option for them?
So I haven't sent anybody for CAR T with CLL just because we have so many good options. And I think most of the CAR T-cell studies that we've been working on have been in aggressive lymphoma and now follicular and mantle cell lymphoma. So I think because we still have allogeneic transplant for those diseases, and that tends to be, you know, a fairly effective modality, I'm not sure where the CAR T-cell, I haven't seen as many studies out there for CLL. It seems like it's really focused on DLBCL and mantle cell.
So let's go to your next patient, the 71-year-old woman with large cell lymphoma.
So she initially presented with follicular lymphoma, and I had seen her as a consult, and at that time she had low volume disease, and she was monitored in the community, and her disease became extremely bulky. I think the issue with when to treat these patients with follicular lymphoma is always a gray one. And I find the GELF criteria to be really helpful in terms of, you know, one nodal station greater than 7 centimeters or 3 greater than 3 centimeters. But she had really, really bulky disease. And I saw her and we started her quickly on BR. And she did great, but she had persistent disease at the end of treatment. And we biopsied that and she had transformed. So we gave her R-CHOP. She had very localized disease, thinking that was going to take care of it with the plan to take her to auto transplant, and she didn't remit. And then we put her on RGDP, and she still had a focus of persistent disease. So she had been seen by Philippe Armand for allogeneic transplant, and we really wanted to get her in remission, so we did focal radiation, and then she, as often happens, developed disease outside of the field. So she had had a lot of chemotherapy. So we put her on lenalidomide, and she tolerated that well and basically had a near CR and got her to allogeneic transplant about a year ago, and she is doing quite well.
What was her subtype?
She was follicular, but transformed follicular.
But I don't know, do you subtype patients in terms of germinal or non-germinal with transformed disease?
Yeah, they're usually germinal center subtype, but not always. And it's interesting because, you know, we think in the de novo DLBCL that the germinal center subtype is going to be less responsive to lenalidomide than the non-germinal center subtype. But I've seen some very good responses in transformed follicular to single-agent lenalidomide.
That's really fascinating. You know, I'm curious about your experience with lenalidomide and diffuse large B-cell because I hear from investigators that they routinely will consider it outside a trial setting in advanced disease down the line, and some people benefit. And yet, when we ask general oncologists, there's a significant fraction who never use it. Do you consider it useful?
Using it up front with chemo?
No, I'm talking about in relapse disease.
Oh, relapse.
They don't use it in relapse disease.
Oh, I think it's a good drug in relapse disease because it's well tolerated, and I've seen people have very good remissions. And sometimes it buys you time to get someone to a clinical trial or in a patient who's not a transplant candidate for auto. And then there was that data at ASH where they looked at older patients who got salvage chemotherapy, and then they randomized them to lenalidomide or observation, and those who got lenalidomide actually did quite well and, you know, better than you would have anticipated. So I think it was randomized, but...
Yeah, no, I was curious. I was going to ask you about that as well, because that was kind of like a maintenance strategy.
Yeah, I liked that study. I thought it was an appealing approach for an older patient.
Liked it enough to try it?
Oh, yeah, I would in an older patient because you know that your salvage chemotherapy, if you have someone who can get some dose-reduced salvage, you know that's not going to cure them. There's like a 10% chance. So I think that's a nice strategy.
So that actually introduces something else I was going to ask you about actually before, but since you brought up this paper looking at lenalidomide maintenance after diffuse large B-cell, there are also a couple papers on lenalidomide maintenance in CLL.
Yeah.
And I was curious what you thought about that.
Well, I think it's a little bit less appealing in CLL, you know, because I think those patients have other very good options. I think, you know, if back in the day when that lenalidomide data first came out in CLL, I think a lot of us started treating patients and saw horrific toxicity in patients who had active disease in terms of tumor flare and people getting very, very ill. And, you know, the other thing is I think a lot of if patients have had FCR and other things, the secondary malignancy and the effect on bone marrow stem cells makes me a little bit nervous. So in CLL, I think we have enough good other drugs that I'm not sure that I like that drug so much in CLL. But
going back to this patient's presentation when she was treated with, you know, routine treatment for FL up until now, anyhow, where it talks about bendamustine, I was curious what you thought about the big plenary paper at ASH that looked at obinutuzumab chemotherapy and follicular lymphoma up front.
So, you know, I think it's interesting. It's a little bit better. You know, I'd like to see a little bit longer term follow-up. And I think the other thing is that we don't routinely do maintenance. I think most people in the U.S. who treat patients with BR do not do rituximab maintenance. And there was that study presented at ASCO last year by Rummel in mantle cell, where they randomized patients with mantle cell who got BR to maintenance or no maintenance, and there was no difference. You know, raising the question, is there something different about the way that bendamustine impacts T cells or immune cells that would make maintenance rituximab less effective? So, you know, I think I am using obinutuzumab in people who, say you give, have a patient now who had single agent rituximab and progressed with follicular lymphoma. So I'm going to give her obinutuzumab plus bendamustine because I know she isn't rituximab sensitive, but I want to give her an antibody. So that seems like a setting in which it makes a lot of sense. So yeah, I'm not sure.
So let me play a little bit of devil's advocate here on a couple of things that you just said. First, you said that you don't generally use maintenance after BR and follicular lymphoma.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to say our surveys of both investigators and docs in practice say they do. 2 years.
Yeah. You know, most, if you look at the NCCN committee, the vast majority do not. You know, I think there's never been an overall survival advantage. Patients get hypogammaglobulinemic. They get delayed neutropenia. And if it doesn't change overall survival and you can retreat people, I think most of the academic centers do not use maintenance rituximab. After, if I was giving someone R-CHOP or R-CVP for whatever reason, I think the data there is, you know, I would probably, from the PRIMA, I would probably do that. But after bendamustine, I don't think we have enough data compared to observation to say that it, here we were comparing maintenance rituximab versus maintenance obina. So I think most of, in our practice, people don't tend to use it. You know, we discuss it with patients, but most opt not to.
I've got to check my last survey. I know we did one at ASH of 25 investigators, see what they said. The other thing you said was that it wasn't that great of an advantage, but I see a hazard rate of 0.66.
Yeah, I think when you look at those curves, you know, the absolute benefit is pretty small. I think both are good options. I think we still use a lot of BR, but we're starting to use, you know, we've templated it so we can give it now. And it seems like the pricing is going to be okay. So I think you could go either way.
Always looking at value, you know?
Yeah.
Just to finish out in terms of large cell lymphoma, there were a couple of publications you were involved with I wanted to ask you about. One looking at relapse refractory double expressor and double hit lymphomas. There was a paper in the JCO you just had in January. Can you talk about what you guys looked at?
So they went back and looked at, between our group and City of Hope, looked at the outcome of patients with double hit and double protein expressors, and they did worse. I mean, it was not a surprising outcome, but it just sort of validated what we had anticipated seeing.
How do you approach patients right now with double hit lymphoma, and what trials do you have going on that are exciting?
So we do tend to give the dose-adjusted R-EPOC. I think it's probably the only setting other than primary mediastinal where there is some data to support that it's better than R-CHOP. Though, you know, I'm still, after the Alliance study came out at ASH, looking at R-CHOP versus R-EPOC, I think in general there's not standard diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We know these patients with double hit have a very bad biology, and I'm just not sure that R-EPOC overcomes that. You know, I think when you look at the data from Kieran, and we participated in one of those studies, it looks pretty good. It's like 70% PFS with R-EPOC, but clinically, that's not really what we're seeing. But in terms of upcoming clinical trials, there's going to be a venetoclax plus R-EPOC, which I think is an attractive option targeting BCL2.
That's interesting, really interesting. What about lenalidomide? I know there's a trial out there looking at that up front.
So I think we need to see the results of those randomized studies, because I think we've seen, you know, with the bortezomib data that the phase two studies look great, and then you actually do the randomized study, and for some reason it just doesn't pan out. So I think we're not ready to add lenalidomide or ibrutinib up front, but, you know, I think we really need some new paradigms for treating double hit lymphoma, and I wish we could find some immunotherapy combination or something, because they are so chemotherapy refractory from the outset. You give them R-EPOC, they often have abdominal disease, bulky abdominal disease, they respond and then they progress and then chemo doesn't touch them. And we try to get these patients to CAR T-cell, but there's a limited number of slots and it's really a very difficult problem right now.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, we always try to hit the SNO meeting every year if we can and do a symposium on neuro-oncology. But I see you were part of a paper looking at nivolumab in relapse refractory primary CNS lymphoma. I'm curious what you saw there.
So the patients responded. It was a small case series. I think there were five patients, one of whom was my patient who had, he had primary testicular got IT prophylaxis, and very soon after he finished treatment, on the outside, was sent in with, you know, a seizure and had huge brain mass. And he got methotrexate, autotransplant, and then relapsed very soon after his autotransplant. And he got some focal radiation for an area that was causing seizure, and then went on to nivolumab and has had a complete remission and remains in remission. He had had some ocular disease, and I think that disease is very difficult to treat with any systemic therapy. So he got vitrectomy, but he's doing very well. And we had actually put him on hospice because he had gotten some radiation and his performance status was really declining rapidly as he had started Nevo, and they often have sort of a pseudo progression, and it takes time for the Nevo to work, or the Pembro, or, and we put him on hospice and then got a call from the hospice team saying, well, he's looking pretty good. He's actually starting to get around, and he brought him back in and he had had a complete remission. So he's doing great. So we have a trial. Lakshmi is leading a trial, an international trial of nivolumab in primary CNS and relapsed testicular.
Yeah, that's not the first hospice-like story I've heard with
Chuck. Oh, it was fantastic.
Yeah, it doesn't happen every day, but the fact that it ever happens is amazing.
Yeah.
What are we learning about the biology of primary CNS lymphoma and in terms of the implications in terms of not only checkpoint inhibitors, but also I think there's been stuff with ibrutinib.
Yeah, so it definitely has a unique biology compared to systemic DLBCL. And, you know, there have been studies looking at upregulation of PD-L1. And, you know, I think the ibrutinib is interesting. The other drug that is active in CNS lymphoma is lenalidomide. And there was some data from UCSF at the last ASCO, and I think at ASH this year. The ibrutinib data, there's been some significant toxicity. There was a study at the NCI where they had to close the study down because of CNS aspergillus. And it's unclear whether those patients were on a lot of dexamethasone, but kind of concerning. And I think that they're, you know, we need to be cautious. Study these people carefully instead of treating everybody off-label and seeing what happens.
So let's talk a little bit about mantle cell. And you've got a 66-year-old man.
So this was a guy I met now about, when did I first meet him? 2005, and he presented with stage 4 mantle cell, as the vast majority of patients do. And he, at that time, we were doing R-CHOP. He had a complete remission and followed by auto transplant. And he had read a book, at that time we were not doing maintenance rituximab, but he had read a book called, I think, The Patient from Hell or something like that. It was this patient who was a patient of, I think, Sandra Horning's or someone out in California, where he had read about rituximab and insisted that he get rituximab maintenance. And so this guy said, I really want rituximab maintenance. And we said, okay, it's not unreasonable. And now there's data from the French group presented at ASH this year that showed not only a PFS, but an overall survival benefit, which is really intriguing, because when you look at CHOP versus R-CHOP, there's not a huge difference, but clearly this study was very positive. So I think that that's now become our standard to give post-transplant rituximab.
And you give it for 2 years?
I think the study was 3 years.
So anything else going on in mantle cell that you want to talk about? And the maintenance thing is very interesting. I assume you're using it in the non-transplant situation, maintenance rituximab, or no?
Yes. So we do, because of the, you know, much shorter natural history of mantle cell compared to follicular, I have given it to patients who got BR, though I've had some people have to come off for various reasons. I think what's really exciting in mantle cell is CAR T cells, you know, so that those studies are just getting on board. I think ibrutinib is a good drug. It doesn't, you know, I have a few people who have had quite durable remissions to ibrutinib when people have a complete remission. I'd love to see acalabrutinib in that setting, because mantle cell is, again, a disease of older patients. And I've got a poor guy who just had to cancel for his appointment for tomorrow because he's been hospitalized up in Maine with recurrent atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib.
Wow.
And I think it's going to be a problem. So, you know, I think some of those combination studies with ibrutinib, there's a study that Peter Martin at Cornell did combining ibrutinib and palbociclib. You know, palbociclib we had studied a long time ago as a pilot study in mantle cell and proved that it actually hit the target. And it's a cytostatic drug in mantle cell, but I think the combination approach is very exciting.
Another thing I'm curious about in terms of mantle cell, I'm starting to hear like whiffs of venetoclax.
Yes, yes, it's very active. And in fact, Andy Zelenets, who runs the NCCN lymphoma panel, who's incredibly smart. You know, I think he has quite a bit of experience. And now that they've published the sort of pan NHL study, it's like 75%. So I think it is a good drug, and it's a very attractive drug in people who don't tolerate ibrutinib, just like CLL. So I'm hoping to see some more studies.
So you introduced or you mentioned the topic of CAR T-cell therapy, and I wanted to just sort of get your global take on where we are today with CAR T in B-cell lymphoma. You have a patient, actually, I think you got treated with it, right?
Yes, this is a really fascinating guy.
Why don't we talk about him as a way to sort of get into that, because I'm trying to sort out all the things I'm hearing nowadays.
Yeah, so he's a delightful, he's almost 60, and he presented in 2011 with DLBCL. He had concurrent DLBCL in Flicka, so transformed, got R-CHOP, relapsed soon thereafter, got ICE, got an auto, relapsed again, went on a CDK4 study, did not respond, went on GemOx, I believe, and had a number of cycles of GemOx and progressed, got a cycle of RDHAP, did not respond. And when I met him, he was quite symptomatic. He had bulky disease in the chest, axilla, inguinal region. And he was our first CAR T-cell patient. And he actually had this large node in the chest that became necrotic because it disappeared so quickly, and he developed a fistula with his esophagus, so we had to keep him NPO. But he did fine, and he's recovered from that, and he's now a year out and remains in complete remission.
So he had this huge node that necrosed?
Yeah, it was right adjacent to, it was sort of a subcarinal node, and it just became necrotic, wow. And then he...
What about the more typical CAR T problems? Did he have those?
Yes, so he had cytokine release, he got tocilizumab, he didn't end up going to the ICU, and then he did have, you know, some significant neurotoxicity, but not grade 4. So overall, I mean, I think this is a very exciting modality, but I think we really need to be looking at what are the durable responses, because I think, you know, you look at the responses at the end of treatment and then at 4 weeks, but then there's this big drop-off between a month and 3 months. So I think what we really need to be looking at is, are these durable and what can we do to, there are now trials adding checkpoint inhibitors to CAR T cells to try to amp up the T cell attack. So I think that's very appealing. And I think we also need to be cautious about trying to figure out how to mitigate the CNS toxicity and try to understand that better, because, you know, the deaths that have been seen, not in lymphoma, but in other diseases, have been brain edema, just total disasters. And, you know, you don't really want to give steroids because you worry that you're going to wipe out your CAR Ts. So,
again, you said a whole bunch of things that were really interesting. I'm just trying to contemplate the biology of giving CAR T and a checkpoint inhibitor together.
Yeah. So then you would hopefully enhance your CD8 positive T cells in addition to your CARs and hopefully get a better immune.
What about the effect on, you know, in terms of the CAR T cell therapy itself? Do you think the checkpoint, for example, in terms of cytokine release or this neurotoxicity, any connection?
Hard to know. I mean, the study that is just opening, it's actually a PD-L1, not a PD-1, so it would be tumor cell directed. So maybe that will be less likely to cause interference with the CAR Ts that you've manufactured.
PD-L1 hits the ligand, though.
Right, on the tumor cells. So hoping that you would, in turn, like, engage some additional T cells, I suppose.
Looking again just across the board at B-cell cancers, what's been seen in terms of efficacy with CAR T-cell therapy?
So it's quite variable depending on, you know, I think for DLBCL, it all comers in the KITE study, it's about 40% long-term. With primary mediastinal and transformed follicular, it's higher, so it's more like 60%. My guy's transformed follicular. The follicular, the early data in follicular looks really good, but I think it's been too few patients. And I think it's probably a very attractive disease in which to study CAR T, because you don't have rapidly progressive disease and you may have more time to get, you know, a disease response. I think mantle cell is another disease that I think is very interesting. Not a lot of data yet.
And can you talk more about the toxicities that have been seen, the deaths that have been seen, and which compound and what's going on?
So the deaths were in ALL patients predominantly, and we have a different construct, but there's something different about ALL, you know, and I think in one of the studies where there were deaths, they had used cyclophosphamide conditioning and then decided to add in fludarabine in addition. And I think it was when they added the fludarabine that they saw the toxicity. And is that because the fludarabine's getting in there? Is it because these patients had had prior CNS-directed therapy or have tumor cells in the CNS? You know, I think some of those patients had no evidence of disease in the CNS at the time they got treated. So I don't think it's completely well sorted out, but it's really awful to see these young, you know, particularly in ALL where you have these young adults who are, you know, to have a treatment-related death is just devastating. So I think we really have got to understand better the biology of what's going on in the CNS.
Are the trials being halted at this point?
Yes, those studies were halted. Yeah, the KITE studies, I think, have gone forward. They have a different, they have CD28 as a co-stimulatory molecule, and I think the other was 4-1BB. So there are differences between the CAR T cells, but I think we just, what's going on in the CNS is just poorly understood. And I think when you see these patients have the neurotoxicity, it is really profound. And you've got these older patients who are catatonic or completely delirious. It's rather frightening. And the cytokine release, I think with the tocilizumab, that seems to be extremely helpful. So I think I like this notion of giving it sort of prophylactically to prevent the CRS. And it doesn't, I don't think there's any evidence that it lessens the efficacy of the CAR T.
That's interesting, preventively. Yeah. I haven't heard that before. What about so-called off-the-shelf CAR T?
So, you know, I think they've been doing some of the off-the-shelf, you know, I know the cytotoxic T-cell therapies directed at EBV lymphomas and PTLD. I don't know a lot about the off-the-shelf CAR T, but I think that is very interesting and more broadly applicable because I think right now our major issue is to find slots for our patients. We have plenty of patients who would be potentially eligible for CAR T, but it's just difficult to, because the studies enroll, you know, sort of one patient at a center at a time so that we can keep a very close eye on the toxicity. It's just the demand for slots way outstrips the number of slots that are available. So if there were a off the shelf, I haven't seen any of those studies yet.
Anything else in terms of your general interest, research that you're involved with, clinical topics of importance that we haven't covered?
So we're doing this really interesting study. I don't know whether it's going to pan out or not, but based on some work done in the lab by collaborator at MIT, Mike Heeman and David Weinstock, who's at the Farber, looking at double-hit lymphoma. So they've made this, Mike has made using human stem cells a double-hit lymphoma model and was testing different compounds, including alemtuzumab and cyclophosphamide. And when you combine those two, you get this, the high-dose cyclophosphamide activates macrophages. And when you combine it with alemtuzumab, and these lymphomas are usually CD52 positive, they got like dramatic synergy, which was recapitulated in David's mouse models of double-hit lymphoma. So we are doing a phase one study of alemtuzumab and cyclophosphamide in patients with relapsed double-hit or CD52 positive double protein expressors. And we're kind of excited just as a proof of principle to see whether we can enhance macrophage function, because we clearly need something better in that disease. And I think we should be hopefully getting that open in the not too distant future.
I think I saw that you're involved in a trial in Burkitt's. What are you doing there?
We had been participating in the NCI Burkitt trial, but, you know, I think that one's nearly accrued. And I think our EPOC is good for patients with lower risk Burkitt's, but I just worry about lack of CNS-directed therapy in patients who have higher risk disease. Though it's tolerable, and certainly for an elderly patient, I think our EPOC is a great option.
So I want to finish out with a case that was sent in to me from a doc in practice. And this is a real case that's ongoing that he would really appreciate some input into. I know it's just off the top of your head, you know, you're just hearing this, but here it is. And just give me your thoughts. So a 66-year-old man, COPD, diabetes, deconditioning, a truck driver, and presents with Hodgkin lymphoma and receives ABVD and in cycle two develops dyspnea. The doc said that he was actually dyspneic at baseline and had been previously a little bit. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, it got worse after cycle two, improved with steroids, evaluated by pulmonary, and the consensus was it was bleomycin-induced hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So the bleomycin was admitted for cycle to day 15, the PET after two cycles showed a Deauville 3 in most lymph nodes except for two left inguinal nodes with significant response, but with a small spot of Deauville 4. A few weeks later, the patient was admitted to the hospital, respiratory failure, worsening ground glass opacities, and is found by bronchoscopy to have PCP pneumonia.
Wow.
So he actually said this is the second case of PCP pneumonia that he's had in patients with Hodgkin's, and he thinks maybe he had it before he even got treated. But so his question, I mean, my question, first of all, is what's going on in the lungs? Is it just bleomycin? And then his clinical question is what to do therapeutically.
So I suspect the steroids that he got to treat the bleo lung toxicity predisposed him as well to the PCP, because if you're going to see PCP, it's very, very rare, but it's usually at the very end of therapies and presumably related to the dex that people get as an antiemetic in addition to T-cell dysfunction. In terms of what to do with him, you know, it sounds like he's still responding, and I wouldn't escalate him. He's 66. He's not going to tolerate, you know, brentuximab is not that easy in a 66-year-old, and I would probably still try to give him AVD if he gets better. I would probably do two more cycles and then get another PET scan and see where he is. And, you know, I try to get him to six cycles if he's in CR after four, I think, and then I would probably sit tight. If he's growing, then I think you really need to think about, number one, is this guy an auto candidate? He might be. You know, depending on what his PFTs come back to, depending on what his cardiac function is, you know, his other organ function, 66 is certainly, we've taken people up to 75 with comorbidities because that's really the only known curative approach. And then he would potentially be a candidate for a Thera-based brentuximab consolidation or maintenance, though I suspect with his diabetes, his pre-existing exposure to vinblastine, he's going to get peripheral neuropathy, so he's probably not going to get a full year. But that would be one option. You know, I think the checkpoint inhibitors are going to be problematic in this guy who's had a history of bleo lung. He's had PCP, and he's got COPD. So I think if it's not that that wouldn't be a potential option down the line, but I think I would reserve that for later. I don't think I would give him brentuximab right now because I think combination chemotherapy is more likely to get him to CR, to get him to an auto, because BV has a CR rate of like 30%, whereas combination chemo is probably double that.
What about AVD bevacizumab?
So, I mean, you could do that, but I would probably keep it simple for now and just try to get him through. You know, he sounds pretty sick. Brentuximab, rarely in these older patients, diabetes, other things, he's going to get peripheral neuropathy if you give them together. And he sounds pretty debilitated. I don't know that he would tolerate it that well. I think I would try to. The other thing is, if he has really remitted everywhere else and has some small residual disease in the groin, you could radiate that and hope for the best. You know, he could finish up his chemo, radiate him, and then if he progresses, then okay, you take him to auto. But I don't think you lose much by doing that. He has advanced stage disease, so he's more likely than not to relapse elsewhere, but there's still, you know, maybe even a 50% chance he won't.
So I guess your concern about checkpoint inhibitors is the possibility of pneumonitis from the checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I have seen even in people who, you know, are quite a ways out from it and get another insult like BCNU. I just had a patient who got pretty significant pulmonary toxicity that was much more than I would have anticipated.